Welcome to Modern Digital Applications, a podcast for corporate decision makers and executives looking to create or extend their digital business with the help of modern applications, processes, and software strategy. Now, welcome your host, a recognized industry thought leader in cloud computing and published author, bringing over 30 years of experience, Lee Acheson.
My guest today is Thomas Curran. Thomas is a cloud executive with many years of experience, including VP of Technology and Innovation at Deutsche Telekom and Technical Advisor at Deutsche Börse. He is the co-founder of the Aure Software Foundation, which is the owner of a very popular open source Go-based identity management library named Kratos, along with other open source identity management tools. Now Thomas is co-founders of Aure Corp, an open source identity infrastructure and services company. This is part two of my interview with Thomas. I think everyone has gone to a website and then went on to Facebook and suddenly saw familiar ads and wondered where those ads came from. And this is the sort of thing you're talking about, where they collect all this information to figure out you or aspects about you in order to, in the case of Facebook, target you with the advertising, but other websites that do this too in order to determine who you are and what information they need about you in order to fulfill whatever business goals they have.
Right. So these things are called tracking cookies, and they're used in, you know, almost the same as session cookies in internet communication. So on your device, there's in a web browser, there's a, let's just call it, for simplification, it's a database, a small database of information about what they know about you. In other words, what sites you came from, what you've typed in, how long you might look at a certain site, and then that information is used, it's actually sold then to advertisers in real-time advertising platforms.
I kind of have a vision of a triangle in my mind here. You have anonymous at one corner of a triangle. You have, you know your customer, where, you know, banks or governments have to know who you are, that you are who you say you are. And then on this third end, there is knowing who your consumer is without necessarily knowing details about them. You don't have a legal obligation to know who they are, but you have a business requirement to know what types of things they're interested in. And then kind of right in the middle of this whole thing are constantly changing legal requirements about how this information can be used and should be used, things like GDPR and HIPAA. Can you talk a little bit about how all that fits into the concept of identity as well?
Well, I think what you're talking about broadly is the whole era of digitization and how you move from, you know, let's say, I guess in Seattle, if you want to rent an apartment, the renter might ask you for a copy of your driver's license or your passport or some other documentation. We have the convenience that people, some sense of security that you are who you say you are. Now, if you said, I'll give you my Facebook ID and username, you know, they might not consider that a real valid form of identity. Why is that? Because it's not state issued. But of course, you could argue Facebook with 2 billion users and big data centers is probably better than any state figuring out really who you are. There's no service that Facebook offers to third parties besides advertising that would enable them to do that. You know, I think we're playing catch up now, where a big part of the world still using forms of identity that are not digital. Think back to this mysterious airplane that went missing over Malaysia, Malaysian Airlines, who knows where it is. But the fact is, there were numerous people that were supposedly on the plane, and they showed up in the press a few days later, alive and well in Italy. And the reason was that their ID, their identity in the form of a driver's license, was photocopied at a rental service in Thailand and then used to create a passport in the Philippines, and then they use that to board an airplane. So again, the point I'm making is that digitization is giving us a lot of ways to misuse identity in the physical world about people. And one of the concerns that the industry has, and certainly being anonymous is one of them, but not being able to figure out who someone is and cross-check that with other physical properties is a big issue for many application providers. In the case of Facebook, it's not regulated. In the case of banks, it is regulated. But, you know, would you want to give your bank a copy of your passport? Probably not. But of course, because of the convenience of having a bank account, you're totally prepared to do that. There are, of course, many different laws. One is money laundering and anti-money laundering, which has to do with know your customer. And the other one is, broadly speaking, privacy of information. Unfortunately, those two things are not very well aligned, in the sense of, you know, you're being asked, because of the convenience of making digital information available, you're often asked to do that at the expense of privacy. And I think that's something that companies like Facebook and Apple, and in general cloud services, are very concerned about. This sort of spiraling up now of privacy versus digital identity and verification data is, I think, becoming an issue for many different industries. Medical care, to be, you know, just entering into the United States and having a retina scan and other types of information being collected is a scary experience for a lot of people, not because it hurts, but just because they feel like there's something going on that they don't understand. And again, this is happening in many situations. So I think these two worlds are driving a lot of technology, but they're also creating a schism in many places in how we operate socially, financially, in the business context.
There's some interesting dichotomies that go on there. Is the internet is anonymous, yet the one place you don't want to put information to maintain anonymity is to put it in the internet. Also, you said that offline identity is compromised given online identity. In other words, you can copy your offline identity online and make use of it in such a way that compromises the quality of offline identity. And the reverse also is therefore true then, right? In order to have completely reliable online identity, we have to get rid of offline identity, and vice versa, right? I mean, it's almost like you can't have both. You have to have either all identity management offline or all identity management safely online.
It's very difficult to have both. And I think it's, again, we're in this, maybe we're both lucky to be in this phase that's now, it's not that old. I mean, you know, even 5 years ago, you traveled a lot, so this is just a random example, but, you know, you have frequent traveler cards, hotel preferred guest cards, and, you know, pretty soon you have a wallet that you can't fit in your pants anymore. So you have to, you know, you thought, well, gee, this is great. My iPhone has a wallet. I'll just take photos and put them in there. And then when I get to the, you know, I'm ready to get into the international lounge in Heathrow Airport to take a shower or something, and of course, you have your phone and you have your digital copy that you made of your card. And they say, well, I want to see the physical version of this. Yeah. And, you know, this is...
You have to scan it somewhere or something.
Right. But now, if you think about it, now today, you have, each airline has an app. And, you know, again, it's a little bit, it's a similar problem, but you just have to download the apps, and then you have maybe access via this digital footprint. And I'm saying 5 years is probably about what I would estimate that, you know, that especially in some areas, travel being one of them, where digital identity is more of a reality than it was, you know, in the past. Now, again, if you take the rental market or the banking industry, you'll find that they're less progressive, and probably since these are things where they expect someone to show up in person, maybe also slower to adopt the things. But I think passports, you know, you have a passport, at least in Europe and the United States, you have what's called biometric passports. And biometric passports means there's a chip installed in the passport. But still, you're asked to copy that passport. That's made available, so you would not have to copy it. But still, you're asked to copy it in many situations.
Yeah, for fear of opening a whole other can of worms, I like your airline travel example where you have we used to have a billfold filled with tons and tons of cards, and now we don't. But what we have now is a iPhone screen filled with tons and tons of apps. And so we still don't have a digital identity. We have 50 digital identities. And, you know, your Hertz identity is different than your American Airlines identity, is different than United Airlines identity, is different than your Heathrow identity. And there still isn't a good way to coordinate all of that together to have an identity. Do you see us in the future getting to the point where we have an identity or ways of mapping these identities together in some sort of common way?
I think we're on the path to get there. And I think certain companies are using substitutions, for instance, an iPhone, in the sense of it's a device, it's not a person, but it's really the phone that's identifying things. It's not you. You use your face to unlock the phone, but that doesn't mean the phone only responds to you. It could be using a fingerprint to, you know, you've seen this in James Bond or something where they cut the finger off and use it to unlock a phone.
You're not recommending to our audience to cut fingers off, but
neither am I. I'm just saying I've seen this in fictional portrayals on TV. The point is that devices and things that manage digital information, these are much more trustworthy than people. So in other words, it's very predictable that, you know, if you have the person's face recognition and he's downloaded and given in some other information, that this is extremely trustworthy. And the contract now to manage the information is no longer with Thomas or Lee, it's with my iPhone.
Well, we've gone on a lot longer than I expected. I appreciate your time and energy in this. I'd like to close with giving you a little bit of an opportunity to talk about what you're currently working on, which I know is the Ori company and the Ori technology. I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what Ori is doing and what you plan on doing.
Ori started out building computer software applications that can be used by application developers to create better applications that use this security stack to communicate. So the first thing we started at Ori was building this software stack to make that easier to implement. Now, one thing that we learned around all this, all these open source projects, is that companies, while they tend to like open source, are not always able or willing to spend all the time that we would spend on building a cloud deployment infrastructure for all of these things. So one of the things we're building right now, by the way, with your help, thank you for that, is this whole system of how we can create a low latency access network for identities created using this Ori infrastructure. So we're on track to build this commercial service that be a network that works both online and offline so that you can have the use of all of this Ori infrastructure and have one API that lets you create users and verify them and create rules for them all on the fly, so to speak.
I'd like to thank Thomas for talking with me today. You can find his LinkedIn contact information in the show notes, along with information about Ori and what they're doing. If you're building an application that requires identity management, as almost really all applications, modern applications today do, I strongly suggest you take a look at the tools that Ori provides and take a look at Thomas and some of the things he's been talking about. Thank you very much, Thomas, for joining me today.
You're welcome, Lee. Thank you.
This is Tech Tappers, little bits of tech here on Modern Digital Applications.
When did software as a service start? Well, that depends on what you really mean by that term. Depending on how you define SaaS, the answer is either the early 1960s or somewhere around 2005. Back in the early days of computing, all applications ran on a centralized computer. Users accessed the computers remotely, initially via punch cards and later via remote terminals. The central nature of the application is, by a true definition, software as a service. But the modern definition of software as a service is tied much more closely with cloud computing. SaaS nowadays refers to software running centrally, typically in a public or a private cloud environment, and is shared among multiple users. A thin client of some sort, either a web browser or a thin mobile application, is used to front the centralized application. From a business model standpoint, users don't typically buy SaaS software. Instead, they'll rent or lease access to it with monthly or annual fees. Alternatively, the service could be free and supported by advertising or other monetization processes. This is the heart of the business model for social media, for example. So, SaaS is an old term that has been given new meaning in recent years, but it's the recent definition that has really changed the way people think and build software today.
This is Tech Tappers, little bits of tech here on Modern Digital Applications.
Amazon S3, a highly durable, highly available file object storage mechanism in the cloud. This service is the go-to service for most companies that want to store huge quantities of data in the cloud or for long-term persistent object storage. S3 was designed with the goals of being highly available, highly durable, and highly scalable. The design goal for availability is 99.99%, four nines. With the durability of objects at 99.99999999, that's 11 nines. How available? The four nines availability translates to a total of 52 minutes of downtime per year. How durable? The 11 nines durability means that if every man, woman, and child in the world had an object in S3, then Amazon would lose at most one of those objects once approximately every 15 years. These are amazing goals, and it's one of the reasons S3 has such a great reputation as a high-quality object storage system. S3 was one of three initial AWS services and was a big part of AWS's early success.
Thank you for listening to Modern Digital Applications with Lee Acheson. Lee helps executives keep up with industry trends and best practices in cloud computing, application scaling, DevOps, and applications modernization in order to stay in front of disruptive influencers. Subscribe to this podcast to ensure you get each new episode as it's available. Visit mdacast.com for all the resources and publications from Lee and his team. Thank you for tuning in to today's show.